old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. I'm Jeet here of The Nation magazine, the sponsor of the podcast. This podcast is available on all platforming, all podcasting platforms, and some radio stations as well. Canada is usually not considered a land of monsters, but in this age of monsters, it's caught up in the same kind of struggles between anti-system politics and systems politics that has engulfed the world. And there's actually some pretty startling pole shifting in Canada. There's an election coming up at the end of this month, April. As of like early January, around January 20th, when Donald Trump was inaugurated, the Conservatives were looking forward to a huge victory. They were 20 points ahead of the next party, the reigning Liberals. And since then, a lot has changed. Donald Trump's promise to annex Canada as a 51st state has sort of upended Canadian politics. And now the Liberals are in the have a new leader, and that they are also in the lead. To take this all up, I'm very helpful to welcome back Luke Savage. He's a Canadian journalist, widely published in many places, especially Jacobin. And he also has a Substack, which he can tell us about. So first of all, welcome, Luke.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be back.
So let's just get started. What exactly is happening in Canadian politics right now? We're the major players. We have American listeners, so they might need just a lay of the land.
Sure. Well, so we are about a little over 3 weeks into a federal election. And as you said already, I mean, there's been an astonishing shift in the balance of, the race's underlying dynamics. I mean, the Conservative Party for about 2.5 years has been not only in the lead, but they've been enjoying the kind of lead that's actually quite rare in Canadian politics. It's really, I think, been since the 1980s. In the 1984, Brian Mulroney in a previous, I would say, somewhat less right-wing incarnation of the Conservative Party, he won a massive majority, over 50% of the vote in that election. The Liberals far, far behind. But this is really the exception, not the rule. And that seemed to be, the Conservatives have seemed to be poised under the leadership of Pierre Poilievre, who's a longtime, he was a backbencher, first elected in 2004 when he was quite young, later became a cabinet minister in the kind of final years of the Stephen Harper governments. That's 2006 to 2015, when the Conservatives were defeated by Justin Trudeau's Liberals. Poilievre has appeared poised to kind of not only win, but win the kind of victory that has really eluded the Conservative Party. I mean, they have won exactly one majority government in their modern history. The modern Conservative Party was created in 2003 out of the merger of the old Progressive Conservative Party and the Canadian Alliance, which was a sort of Western Canadian-based party, which I would say, pursued a more Americanized style of conservative politics, if I can put it that way. So Conservatives were led by double digits. And, it's a lot of that had to do with the unpopularity of Justin Trudeau. He really was insisting on staying. And I guess somewhat similar to what we saw with Joe Biden in 2024, where, before he announced he was running for a second term, there were polls showing a majority of Democrats even did not want him to run for re-election. Very similar to Justin Trudeau.
And actually, I want to just underscore those similarities. A sort of a party leader who's unpopular and is also really a leader who's offering sort of ancien regime restoration, is representing the kind of centrist politics that has dominated as the alternative to right-wing anti-system politics for the last decade or more. This sort of same politics as sort of like Macron or the Labour Party under Keith Starmer, and Joe Biden certainly, the election that was happening until really January of this year was sort of like right-wing anti-systems politics versus pro-system centrist politics. And the conservatives were running on a very successful slogan, which is Canada is broken. And the liberal response given by former finance minister Chrystia Freeland was Canada has never been broken, which is an astonishing statement, you know, to anyone who knows Canadian society or Canadian history. And it reminded me a lot of, you know, like the you know, situation in America where Donald Trump ran on, you know, make America great again with the statement that, you know, America is now going down the drain and has a corrupt elite and he'll fix it. And then Hillary Clinton responded by saying America has always been great. You know, like a sort of statement of like affirmation of the status quo, which to my mind, like, you know, pretty much risks alienating you know, not just the people, traditional people on the right, but really, like, you know, like anyone who's aware of, you know, the broader problems of society.
Absolutely. And I mean, so the, you know, the cost of living crisis in Canada has been quite serious. And I would say that the sort of visible signs of, you know, crumbling public infrastructure, you know, underfunded, all kinds of public underfunding, huge, you know, highly visible spike in homelessness. I mean, absolutely obscene, you know, obscenely high rents, that kind of thing. All these things will be familiar to you know, non-Canadian listeners, but all this stuff is very much happening here too. And as you just said, Jeet, I mean, the response of the Liberals was basically, you know, if you kind of point this stuff out, it's unpatriotic or something, like attacking, criticizing institutions or citing examples of institutional failure is populism, which is very naughty and dangerous, as we all know.
Or it's disinformation.
Or it's disinformation. And so Paul Yevrey, you know, the leader of the Conservative Party, if we want to give him some, you know, credit is the wrong word, but I think you all know what I mean. He, I think, borrowed something. You know, I think he's quite a distinctive figure from Donald Trump. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to suggest there's too many parallels between the two. They're both right-wing politicians, but I think somewhat different kinds. But something I think he perhaps borrowed from Trump, or that we saw Trump do more than perhaps the, you know, what was then the GOP mainstream in 2016, was just acknowledge social hardship, right? Instead of kind of sort of explaining it away. You know, Donald Trump in 2016 promised to protect certain entitlement programs and that sort of thing. Obviously, we could see how hollow that is in his second term, especially. But I think, you know, that was working. And the Conservatives, it should be said, have actually won the popular vote in the last two federal elections. But they don't have, you know, under Canada's electoral system, their vote is much less efficient than the Liberal vote. And so, you know, what they really needed to do to win an election is for the Liberals to remain sort of, you know, under 35% of the total vote. And they need to get their kind of floor from 33 or 44% up to about 40. They got a majority government with a little less than 40% in 2011 under Stephen Harper. And as soon as a number of things happened, the entire dynamic changed, right? Justin Trudeau was forced out. You know, it was that's a whole story in and of itself, but he was finally forced out after, you know, numerous cabinet resignations and people saying they weren't going to run again, that sort of thing. Donald Trump was inaugurated and started talking about wanting to annex Canada and these, you know, very high tariffs and things. And then finally, the Liberals, you know, elected a new leader, and Mark Carney, who's the former governor of both the Bank of Canada and the Bank of England, who's never held elected office of any kind before, you know, he won a blowout victory in the Liberal leadership contest, more than 80% of the vote on the first ballot. And, you know, sort of improbably, I think, for 2025, has sort of stepped into this fold as a kind of tabula rasa onto which people can more or less project whatever they want. But he is seen by some anyway as a sort of unifying figure whose boringness, if I can put it that way, is the point. I think it's unlikely that a figure like Carney could be successful in a different context, but right now he's given the Liberals, it seems, quite an edge.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right, that this is a case of the man meeting the moment, because Carney has been talked about as a possible replacement for Trudeau for a long time. And I have to say, like, in the past, I did actually think, like, if the Liberals really wanted to commit political suicide, having the face of your party as a sort of central banker, you know, a central banker of, like, not just like Bank of Canada, but, you know, Bank of England, seemed like, you know, like a way of really dooming yourself. But I mean, you know, like, the, you know, once Trump started to talk, you know, was reelected, and started talking about, you know, like annexing Greenland and Canada and Panama, then suddenly, like, you know, that changed the question of the election from, is Canada broken, which I think the Conservatives would have won on that, to, like, you know, how can we save Canada? And in that situation, both a very safe, you know, boring banker seems preferable, and the Liberal Party itself, I think, has certain advantages because of its sort of, you know, going back more than a century, it has sort of structured itself as the, you know, natural governing party of Canada, and the Party of National Unity as the one party that has had a long track record of, you know, strength in both English and French Canada.
Yeah, I mean, for you know, American listeners may not realize, but I mean, the Liberal Party of Canada is not just a successful political party, it is, I believe, the most successful party in the history of mass suffrage, at least in the 20th century. I mean, the Liberals governed Canada with only a few interludes. There was John Diefenbaker's Conservative government from 1957 to 1963, and Diefenbaker was in the minority for a few of those years. And then there was Brian Mulroney, 84 to 1993 or thereabouts, and then, you know, Stephen Harper again in the minority for the majority of his time in office, 2006 to 2015. And besides that, it's just a sea of Liberal prime ministers, some of them personally very unpopular, some of them elected to huge parliamentary majorities with 35% of the vote or something like that. But the Liberals have very much been at the, I suppose, vanguard of Canadian state building since 1945, and because of that, they and as you said, they have been sort of the party of biculturalism. They've historically, you know, in some cases, they've been able to win majority governments basically by winning Ontario and Quebec, which, you know, the sort of Montreal-Toronto corridor is very much kind of the traditional nexus of power, political, culture, and otherwise in Canadian society. And so the Liberals, for all those reasons, institutionally, have been, I think, quite poised to, they're quite well disposed to exploit a moment like this once they got rid of, you know, a very unpopular leader.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. I think the statistic is that in the 20th century, the Liberals governed for 70 out of 100 years, which is, like, you know, like there's very few other parties. I think actually the Conservative Party in England is maybe in the running, but I think that the Liberals have governed for a longer period. And certainly in the case of England, the times that Labour has governed, especially after the first decade after World War II, they were able to, you know, change society in a way that no party in Canada has. So I think the Liberal Party has is able to present itself as the natural unifying party. And certainly Carney, I think some of what he's done as well is to sort of defang opposition to the Liberals by, you know, a move to the center and absorbing some of the sort of conservative complaints.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing that Pierre Poilievre and the Conservatives were hoping for and what they've been planning for several years was, you know, an election on the carbon tax, basically. So the Liberals' signature environmental policy was this consumer carbon tax. And Carney was very clear as soon as he ran for the leadership. And I believe, there was no Liberal leadership candidate who was saying wholeheartedly, we want to keep the consumer carbon tax. I mean, the Conservatives very successfully demonized this policy. I happen to think the policy had a lot of limitations anyway, both in terms of I don't think consumer incentive programs are the best way to fight climate change. That's a whole other conversation. But also because there was a sort of too clever by half design where a lot of people did get rebates. The majority of people paying this tax got rebates, which meant that they either, you know, they either got checks in the mail, they either made money from this program, or it wasn't functionally a tax. But I think that, you know, most people didn't really notice that, right? And so when there's a cost of living crisis and the conservatives spend 2.5 years saying, oh, there's this tax, and it's why, you know, it's why energy is so expensive and gas is so expensive, and it's why you're feeling squeezed in your pocketbook, it was very, very effective. But Carney abandoned the tax right away. In fact, I think it was his first act when he was sworn in as prime minister. And, you know, also he eliminated the capital gains tax increase that the liberals introduced last fall. There've been another number of these areas where, yeah, I mean, this is very much a sort of a center right pivot. And Carney has been able to do that so far anyway, without seeming to lose sort of center left voters. In fact, right now, plenty of them seem to be considering voting for the liberals. And I think, again, that's because of this, Trump crisis and this tariff war and these annexation threats has sort of overshadowed everything else and overshadowed all other significantly overshadowed anyway, other things that could potentially have been the ballot questions here.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And I mean, I was actually like at a meeting, a talk with a Canadian journalist, Nora Loretta, and we had a very left-leaning crowd coming out for that. And I talked to a lot of people, and there were a lot of people who were saying that for the first time in their lives, they're thinking of voting liberal. And that has led to, you know, the other big story, which is, you know, not just the sort of, you know, conservatives have lost what they seem to have lost, what looks like their opportunity to have a majority or to win the election, but also like the left party, the New Democratic Party, had been like, you know, poised to do. I mean, you could have imagined interesting things happening if it wasn't for the Trump thing, because as the liberals were sinking, the NDP had remained steady and was like, you know, within range of them. And you could see possibly them making an argument like, you know, what were the alternative to the conservatives? And, you know, obviously that's not going to play out now. And in fact, it looks like it by the polling, NDP has lost like more than half of its strength. And so those voters are obviously going towards the Liberals. And also in Quebec, the Bloc Québécois, which is for American listeners, Quebec a sovereigntist party, but also of the center left, and perhaps actually like more to the left than any of the other major parties, they have also seen a considerable decrease in strength going to the Liberals. So in some ways, there is a kind of, because of Trump, and I think American listeners will be familiar with this is the Joe Biden phenomena, you know, like a move towards like a sort of centrist alternative, and it includes people on the left bandwagoning into the center.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're seeing, or what we appear to be seeing, of course, you know, the election's not over, so things can change, and we're recording this before the major English language leaders debate, which is going to be a few days from now, and I suppose will be have been 2 or 3 days ago by the time all of you listening hear this. But so we don't know where things will end up. But indeed, there seems to be a kind of rally around the flag effect that's going on at the moment. And if people think back to sort of maybe the early, very early days of the pandemic, when you know there were various incumbent governments around the world that called early elections because they sensed, you know, conditions like this often redound to the benefit of incumbent power because there's a sort of a small C conservatism, if you want, that prevails in moments like this, an aversion to change or, you know, experimentation and so on. And a lot of those governments that called those early elections got reelected. And so I think one way of interpreting what's happening is that I think if we're talking about the New Democratic Party, Canada's longtime social democratic party, the party someone like myself votes for and you know is in the closest sympathy with by far. I mean, I think one factor also influencing what's going on, or one possible way of interpreting this, I'm not sure how much weight to afford it, but the NDP had a confidence in supply agreement with the Liberals, has for the past several years. Jagmeet Singh, the leader of the NDP, pulled out of that deal last fall. But the deal, which was sort of a parliamentary agreement in which the NDP agreed to vote with the government on matters of confidence in exchange for certain measures, including, you know, anti-scab legislation in the public sector, beginnings of a publicly funded pharmaceutical program, means tested dental program, so an expansion of dental benefits to millions of people, low income people. These kinds of things, you know, the NDP kind of extracted these from the Liberals. And, you know, it's possible that one consequence of that has been to, you know, make it harder for the NDP to assert a distinctive identity so close to or so, you know, when it's been so recently associated with the Liberals because of this deal. I mean, just speaking generally, it has, I think, usually been the case. There may be exceptions to this, but I'm not aware of major ones. It has usually been the case that when parties do this, when they're sort of the smaller party, or when they enter formal coalitions, which this was not, but usually in those situations, the junior partner doesn't do well electorally out of things, because the incumbent party that, you know, that actually enacted the reforms tends to get the credit. And that's something that's happened throughout the history of the New Democratic Party, specifically. It's happened to the NDP, and before that it happened to the NDP's precursor, the CCF as well, which in the 1930s successfully, you know, organized a national campaign for all kinds of public ownership and social insurance and this kind of thing. And in 1945, the Liberals said, okay, well, we're just going to write something that could almost have been a CCF budget, even though we were against this stuff until a month ago. And of course, they won the election, which the CCF had been poised to win before that. So there is some precedent to the you know, possible interpretation of events I'm giving.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And it's a real dilemma for the NDP historically. I mean, I do actually think, and it's something, you know, maybe worth talking about or, you know, even arguing through a little bit, because, like, in terms of, like, actually affecting, like, you know, substantial change that improves lives, I think the NDP has had two options. One is that on provincial level, if they win on a provincial level, as in like here in Saskatchewan, where I am right now, you know, they can implement things like universal healthcare, and that can be, you know, copied elsewhere. But the other option on a federal level has been to, like, work with the Liberals. I mean, the situation where the Liberals are in a minority and need NDP votes, and the NDP can push them to adopt policies. That is basically the basis of the Canadian welfare state as we know it, right? That but I mean, that doesn't necessarily pay electoral dividends. And I think I've, you know, talking to people in the NDP, like, you know, there's a sort of question. Like, I mean, I think there's definitely people who think, like, well, you know, like, the main thing is to get the policies through, right? Like, it's actually, like, a, you know, a real achievement that we're going to have dental coverage as part of healthcare, right? You know, I think there's another aspect of, like, well, you know, like, maybe you could do much more if you're aiming to actually gain power. I don't know. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that because of the role that the NDP has historically played, I think some people, there are certain voters, and I mean, I've talked to voters like this at the doorstep. They kind of conceive of, you know, they know they're not going to vote for the Conservative Party. But then sort of beyond that, they almost conceive of the political dynamic like an ecosystem, where the role of the Liberals is to govern and the role of the NDP is to sort of, you know, goad and push and pressure, particularly in minority parliament situations. And I mean, to that, I would just say that the people who founded the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, the precursor to the NDP, and the people who founded the New Democratic Party, that's not why they built these organizations, right? The goal was never to simply create a pressure group to make the Liberals do things. The goal was to replace the Liberals as one of the two major parties. And if you want to realign the political spectrum in Canada, which is historically sort of, you know, it's I think swung more on these questions of national unity, these questions of identity, these sorts of things, than it has around a traditional left-right divide, you know. So the, you know, the purpose of having a social democratic party in Canada has always been to win power and actually, you know, implement a social democratic agenda. And I frankly think if the CCF had succeeded in forming a government in 1945, or if the NDP had formed one in the 60s or 70s, I think we would probably be a lot closer to a Scandinavian country in terms of how our institutions operate. And instead, we're sort of, you know, we have a stronger welfare state and superior public programs, at least in many areas, than the United States. But, you know, we're not Norway, right? We're not Sweden. And so, I mean, my view of that, speaking not only, I guess, as a commentator, but also as an ideologically motivated person, is I'm not interested in, you know, I think it's great when, you know, you can have a party of the left that extracts gains from the center or makes liberal politicians do things they otherwise wouldn't want to do. But I don't think that's not an end in itself. The end is to form a national social democratic government and implement a social democratic program on a scale that it will never be implemented by, a party of the neoliberal center or something, which is basically what the Liberal Party of Canada is at this point.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very compelling point. And I think maybe, you know, going into the future, what has happened in Canada in the past is there's been, on a provincial level, you've seen the NDP supplant and replace the Liberals as the sort of, you know, center left party. And in those situations, it gets to, you know, in the normal course of things, govern on occasion, right? And then make substantial changes. And the question is, like, when can that happen on a federal level? And certainly all these, you know, developments with Trump have delayed that process. I'd still speaking on the NDP, I mean, there's another thought I've had, which is that in terms of the particular leadership of Jagmeet Singh, which is that he you know, is to the left of Justin Trudeau, but came into sort of national prominence roughly the same period, and is of a politician of a certain tenor or caliber. Trudeau used to talk about like sort of like sunny ways. It's a kind of like Obama, you know, situation of like, you know, we're gonna offer positive vision, hope, and with a lot of social media, a lot of outreach to young people, and not a lot of anger. And I think that sort of politics has fallen like out of favor, that it is not, even though like Carney with his boringness is appealing right now, but I mean on a more broad level, like I had often had the thought that an angrier leader, like a Bernie Sanders type figure, if they were leading the NDP, I could name, you know, as, someone like Charlie Angus is a NDP member of parliament, although he's not running again, but certainly like he is has a different tenor or approach to politics and is much more willing to articulate sort of like anger. And I'm wondering whether maybe that's not an issue with the NDP, like you know, are they going to need a leadership change, and would they need a leader that can maybe more speak to the kind of, you know, frustrations that, you know, we've been talking about?
Well, on the specific question, you know, the election's not over yet, so that's really above my pay grade. But I think anti-system politics or pro-system politics, these things have varying levels of appeal depending on the context. And I think that what we've seen coming from the right in Canada, I mean, the Conservatives are not where they were hoping to be, and it seems increasingly less likely that they will be. But nonetheless, they are higher in the polls, even as they're trailing the Liberals, than they have been in previous elections. And I do think one of the ways you can interpret that is that they have successfully capitalized on anti-system sentiment, right? And with the NDP, I mean, there has been the NDP program is, I would say, much closer to a traditional social democratic program in the best sense today than it was when, you know, I was when I was growing up or when I was in university. But anti-system politics isn't really what I would associate with most of its presentation. And I think in a moment like this, we can see that there are some limitations to that. I mean, it's funny because Carney, in his own way, I mean, he's clearly right. He's not an anti-system politician, right? He's the very definition of a system politician. And yet I think because he has not held elected office, before. And because, you know, if you're a Canadian and you're the kind of person who reads sort of airport books by, you know, B-stream public figures, yeah, you probably heard of Mark Carney, because he's been that sort of a figure for 10 or 15 years now. But I don't think most voters had much sense of Mark Carney. So he's actually just kind of this shiny new object. And so I think in a kind of an abstract sense anyway, he himself is sort of cashing in, at least in an ephemeral way. I don't think this is durable, but I think he's cashing in on a sort of, or he's capitalizing on a kind of an anti-system politics, which is absurd, you know, given that, you know, as we mentioned, he was a head of a major global asset management company, the head of two G7 central banks. And before that, he worked at Goldman Sachs for 13 years. So he's not an anti-system politician, but I do think in the current electoral climate, I do think he's harvesting some anti-system energy.
Yeah, well, no, because he can, because he's like running against Trump in effect, right? And so it is like the system is like this big bad American president, and then he can kind of appeal to more vernacular Canadian forms. I mean, like his commercials aren't stuff that would appeal to me, but he is appealing to, you know, having like, you know, Mike Myers and talking about hockey or doing these videos where he's talking about his love of, you know, Canadian punk rock bands and then I mean that sort of stuff. I think it's, as you said, it's not going to be lasting, because he is actually the most pro-system person imaginable. Like you cannot see a better embodiment of the system, except that, you know, he's against Trump, right? So maybe we should spell out like sort of Carney's vision or where he's exactly coming from in general, because I mean, to say he's pro-system, you can flesh it out a little bit. He has a book out, has sort of like values. I would actually define him as maybe like Obama, like maybe the sort of, you know, the smartest that liberalism has to offer. Like, he's actually a very intelligent man, very accomplished man. And he is as aware as anyone who's listening to this program of like the actual systematic crises that we're facing. He's aware of climate change. He's aware of income inequality. And in a sense, like, you know, with his talk about values, he's offering a very old, you know, almost 19th century vision. This is the vision of Charles Dickens, right? You know, like George Orwell said, Dickens was believed that you have to just have a change of heart, right? You have these bad Ebenezer Scrooge, the billionaires, and they're misers. But if they could just like be visited by ghosts and have a change of heart, and they would see that they have to look after the poor of society. And, you know, like, I love the Christmas Carol. I watch it every year with my kids. But, you know, like, I don't think that's a viable political position. You cannot just like change the hearts of the ruling class to get them to be more concerned about climate and inequality. That's not going to do the trick.
No, and it's funny, I hadn't the sort of 19th the parallel with 19th century British, and I think quite specifically English liberalism had not occurred to me. But no, you're absolutely right. And I mean, if we're speaking historically, it's only when the British working class begins to develop significant power through the trade union movement and later the Labour Party, it supplants the Liberal Party, but also absorbs a certain amount of the, if you want, the better and more progressive side of middle class liberalism. And that's when you get the big changes that define British politics in the middle of the 20th century. That's where you get the welfare state and the Beveridge Report. You know, Beveridge was actually a liberal himself, William Beveridge. That's where you get the Attlee government and the welfare state. So I think that's a lineage that had not occurred to me, but I think you're absolutely right. And I mean, this speaks to a really profound philosophical difference that someone like me, and I suspect you as well, have with someone like Mark Carney. And I think it reflects a much deeper difference between the way that those of us on the Democratic left view the world and view politics as compared to the way that liberals see it. I mean, Carney, I mean, one of the things that is so baffling about him, because as you said, and I agree, I mean, he is in a certain sense quite an intelligent person. He is able in his books and he illustrates for us, he demonstrates that he is aware of, you know, market failures and things like that. He's aware that injustice exists. He doesn't have a naive view of the status quo in that sense. But on the other hand, his worldview entirely precludes him by default from kind of seeking structural explanations or deeper material explanations for why, you know, injustice exists. And so this leaves him, as you said, you know, like Charles Dickens in A Christmas Carol, a book I incidentally love as well, but where, you know, yeah, we just need, you know, we're destroying the planet through ecological degradation and inequality is soaring and et cetera, et cetera. And the legitimacy of the democratic state is being eroded everywhere. But hey, if we just had a more enlightened business class, if we had sort of a different class of experts that was specifically or sufficiently benign in the way it approached the world, you know, we don't have to choose. There's a golden mean always to be found for this sort of liberal between, you know, the ethical demands of a just society and the structures of liberal democratic capitalism. And that is how Carney views the world. And I think that view is it's incorrect for moral and ethical reasons. It's belied by historical precedent. I don't think that's how progressive political change has tended to happen. And I think just importantly, and, you know, this is where, again, we're going to take off my pundit hat and put on my idea, you know, my hat as somebody who's ideologically motivated. I mean, I think it's important to stress, you know, this is not going to work. The Carney program on its own terms is not going to work because it's you know, enacting a center right program is not going to get us any closer to addressing any of these, you know, these major questions. It's not going to create a more equal society. It's not going to reverse the kind of, you know, decades long decline in the capacity of the democratic state, you know, to intervene in the interests of social or public good in the marketplace, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it is the same vision of, you know, a cocktail of tax cuts and business incentives and maybe selective state investments, although even in many cases, ones that merely subsidize the private sector to encourage private investment. You know, that's not going to eradicate the record homelessness we're seeing, right? It's not going to deal with the structural problems in the housing market, which have to do with financialization and other things. And I, you know, I could go on and on, but you know, it's not going to work. And so I think that is very important to register here, even as we acknowledge that in a moment like this one, a figure like Mark Carney has, you know, undeniable appeal in this election.
Yeah, no, I know, I absolutely agree. I mean, I don't quite see anything in his political vision, but I mean, I think it's an interesting tension that on the one hand, there's this sort of move towards the center of like having this safe figure like Mark Carney, but actual like politics in the sense of, you know, what people are dissatisfied by, what are actual like, you know, concerns of anxiety. Like obviously Trump is a big thing, but it's, you know, it's because Trump embodies this kind of, you know, a right-wing vision of the world, which I think most Canadians, you know, I would say 60-70% or more Canadians kind of reject. And in addition, you have all the issues of like, you know, housing and the sort of, you know, failures of the system, which the conservatives are exploiting, which are still there. And so like, I don't see the public has moved towards the center, even as they're supporting the centrist politician. So to me, that's a contradiction or tension that could play itself out in very interesting ways. But also, I have to say, I mean, to give Carney credit or to maybe think, you know, this is something new. It's not quite like Joe Biden anymore, because, you know, the fact that Trump was reelected has actually like destroyed a major pillar of centrist liberal thought, which is support for American global hegemony, right? And, you know, like politicians, not just in the United States, but like I think the American empire is always dependent upon like, you know, people in Canada and in Europe, center left, center right politicians that have supported the Atlanticist worldview. And the Liberal Party has actually been more in that direction than the conservatives have. I mean, like, yeah, we had mentioned John Diefenbaker before, but he, you know, got into trouble because he actually opposed, like, you know, the Kennedy administration foreign policy. And the Kennedy administration went out of its way to sabotage him and to elect a liberal government. But now Carney has said, like, you know, like our relationship with the United States has changed and that it is, you know, for someone like him to have said, say something like that is a really startling thing. Now, you know, it's interesting to think about, like, well, what does, if, you know, support for American hegemony had been, like, you know, a pillar of this kind of centrist thought, and then, you know, it's no longer there. Where do we go from there? Yeah, I mean, there's different directions. There's a kind of right-wing element of this, of rearming, you know, aligning ourselves with the remaining, you know, like the NATO countries that aren't the United States. But it does seem like, you know, like he is kind of facing an existential crisis of his own ideology.
Yes, I mean, and that is, I think, you know, liberals throughout North America and Europe are facing that exact dilemma, because they're suddenly confronted with the reality that this world order that they've invested themselves in for so many decades, you know, even though, you know, it has these institutions that are independent from the United States, right? It has international institutions, it has the European Union, et cetera, et cetera. You know, Canada has its own latitude that it operates, you know, within. It's not, you know, entirely, you know, doesn't act merely as a proxy for the United States, certainly not. But, you know, when the United States in the span of a few weeks basically says we want to undo the entirety of the global trade regime, which in Canada has been, I mean, the North American trade regime, the continental one, has been, you know, since the advent of free trade in the 1980s, absolutely integral to the Canadian economic model and integral to Canada's political consensus. So you have the undoing of the trade consensus, you have the Trump administration, you know, I mean, I think some people kind of describe them as more pacifist or isolationist. I don't like to think about it in those terms. I think it's just they have a different view of how
they're
to
unilateralist.
Manage the,
yeah, I mean, they're, yeah. They're, yeah, and they're like openly trying to run NATO as a protection racket rather than, you know, like at least have the illusion of a partnership.
That's right. And they see the world. They see the world differently. So they see, you know, the principal American antagonist is China, which is certainly not something that at least, you know, most American liberals in the mainstream disagree with, but, you know, the you know, Trumpian right anyway, they're a lot less concerned about Russia. So, you know, there are these differences there. But insofar as Canada is concerned, I mean, it's hard to see in the long term. It's hard to predict, I should say, where any of this is going, because, as I said, I don't think the Carney program is really, I don't think it's durable in a lasting way, at least if it remains in the form that we presently see it. And so, I mean, one of the things that's occurred to me since Trump initiated the trade war in particular is that, you know, there may be an opportunity to revive an earlier tradition of kind of left or social democratic nationalism that used to be quite an influential force in Canada. You know, this was a form of Canadian nationalism. And I realize for non-Canadian listeners, this might scan as a little strange because, you know, I think nationalism in the United States is much more of a conservatively coded thing. And that certainly exists in Canada, but particularly in the mid 20th century, in the 1960s, 70s and 80s in particular, many of the most influential nationalists in Canada were social democrats or democratic socialists. There were people who wanted, they wanted to pursue a vision of economic nationalism where, you know, you have public enterprise, you have Canadian ownership of resources, which is a really important issue in Canada because the United States owns a lot of Canada's resource sector. So a lot of the Canadian economy, parts of it, remain in a sense underdeveloped because we have all these, you know, abundant natural resources, but they often are exported to the United States and then Canadian consumers buy them back as finished products. So there was a tradition in Canada, a sort of progressive left tradition that was very interested in dealing with this. And I still think that vision has a lot of, a lot of merit. And I think that the sort of liberal nationalism we're seeing from Carney right now, it manifests itself like the nationalist outpouring in Canada right now is a real one. You know, there's a lot of emotion. People feel understandably quite threatened by Trump's, threats of annexing us and that kind of thing. But it seems to me unless nationalism is affixed, you know, at least if we're talking about in the long term, unless it's attached to, a broader vision of social solidarity and you know, expanded democracy and democratic equality, it's not going to be very very durable. You know, we can't sustain ourselves on Canadian corporations waving the flag and, you know, the government subsidizing the private sector and cutting the capital gains tax, right? That's not a durable vision for a future in which the world and the continental trade consensus look completely different than they have for the last 50 or 60 years.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. We're kind of getting toward near the end of our the podcast, but I want to actually like flesh out that point a little bit more, because historically Canadian nationalism, and I think all like, you know, real nationalisms, you know, have a collectivist political project at its heart, like something that people can rally behind. You know, in the 19th century, is the sort of building of a national railway, the building of national parks. And especially in that sort of like, you know, 1960s, 70s moment, a lot of state building of, you know, like national healthcare, support for Canadian cultural industries, bilingualism as a, you know, national project. And a lot of that, like, you know, came under stress through neoliberalism, supported by both the Conservative Party and the Liberals, like under, you know, Prime Minister Jean Chrétien in the 1990s, and, you know, both parties basically supporting NAFTA and free trade. A lot of the sort of, you know, substance of that nation building project kind of withered away, and the state capacity to do nation building has withered away. And, you know, like, we're not seeing, you know, except among, you know, people like you and me, a lot of talk about this. Except I will give, you know, Carney, like, there's a couple of things he's talked about which I think are kind of interesting. One is that he talked about giving more sustained long-term funding for the Canadian National Broadcaster, the CBC, which would be a major shift from the policies of both Conservative and Liberal governments in recent decades. And he has something a little more small bore, but, you know, he basically suggested Canadians will want a vacation inside Canada because it's so threatening. You know, people could get deported in the U.S. Making the National Railway, Via Rail, free to people under 18, making national parks and museums free. I mean, these are both directionally interesting, although maybe also a little bit small bore. I don't know what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I mean, I agree they're directionally interesting. I think they fit, you know, if you wanted to situate that kind of thing within a tradition, political tradition in Canada, certainly you find that sort of thing, that kind of investment in public or shared goods in the social democratic tradition. You also find it in the so-called Red Tory tradition as well, which has which is an older tradition. Older than, you know, that is the sort of current strand of conservatism that rules the Conservative Party. But as you said, I mean, these are pretty small bore things. I mean, it seems to me it's just unavoidable that, you know, we're going to need pretty large scale intervention by the Canadian state. We're going to need a kind of a quasi developmentalist ethos to be embraced if indeed the entire continental trade consensus is going to come unstuck. You know, right now, for example, we're seeing potentially catastrophic loss of jobs in our automotive sector, which, you know, is one of the, you know, last places where there's really good, you know, decently paid unionized manufacturing jobs, but it's closely integrated. These are American companies operating in Canada, Ford, GM, et cetera. You know, and just having, you know, having like employment insurance for workers who are laid off. I mean, it's not enough. We need to be the federal state. And this is just one example, but the federal state is going to need to intervene much more profoundly to save these jobs, to save these plants. It's going to need to be quite creative, really. And I don't find the resources for that, if you want, in the liberal tradition in Canada. I find them in the, in the democratic socialist tradition. You know, having free museums and things is good. The CBC funding is great, although, and this is a minor thing, it's a quibble, but the $150 million Carney wants to invest is below what the recent, I'm forgetting her name, but the recent Minister of Heritage recommended for what would be needed to have a CBC that was ad-free, which, you know, would be nice. But no, I mean, I when I look at the Liberal program and I compare it with the program the NDP is running on at the moment, I see in the latter an approach and a series of measures that are much more adequate, would be much more adequate to meeting the moment. It's just that that is not the vision that seems to be punching through at the moment. And as I said, I guess, you know, the election isn't over yet, but You know, it's this earlier tradition of a kind of progressive left nationalism, I think, we ultimately need in the current moment.
Yeah, I think that's right. Although, I mean, I think we'll see what happens with the election. But I also think, you know, the politics of all this is not going to end with the election. And I certainly think the national mood, even though it's rallying behind Carney at the moment, I think there's a real potential for like some major shifts in thinking, and that's certainly something that's, you know, continue. Anyways, I want to thank Luke again. Do you want to mention your Substack?
I've been writing about a lot of the things we've been discussing, so if you're interested in reading more on that or all the other things that I put on there, lukewsavage.com, you can find my Substack, or just googling Luke Savage and Substack.
Okay, great. And so again, thank you. It was a very productive talk, I thought.
Cheers. It was fun.
This country was built on a distinctly American work ethic, but today work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries, and with that, we sent away good jobs and diminished our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make a variety of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more. All made right here in the USA, from growing the cotton and adding the final touches. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs for seamsters, cutters, and factory workers in towns and cities across the United States. And it's about more than an income. Jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.